Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program. It is being recorded for the listening week that begins May 11th, and your reader's name is Susan Shirey. This week you will be hearing recent news and events, also an historical profile piece in a nod to the recent Kentucky Derby on a self-taught veterinarian and his famous horse from the 1800s. Also, some commentary on the recent docuseries on Netflix titled Black Twitter, A People's History. Our sources vary, as usual, and will be announced at the beginning of each article. First, an obituary from the New York Times. This was posted May 6th, written by Alex Williams. Gail McKinney Griffith, Dance Theater of Harlem star, dies at 74. A founding dancer with the groundbreaking company, she served not only as a principal dancer, but also as its first ballet mistress. When Gail McKinney Griffith was an aspiring ballerina auditioning for Juilliard in the late 1960s, her excitement was tempered by a daunting realization. Quote, "When you walk into a room and you're the only black person there," she later said, "you right away develop this persona that is protective, but also standing strong. You're used to thinking two things at once. Yes, I'm the only black person here. And yes, let's do this." End quote. That attitude not only helped her gain admittance to that elite arts institution, it also carried her through a 9-year career as a founding member of Dance Theater of Harlem, the groundbreaking New York troupe that provided overdue opportunities and international acclaim to black ballet performers. As was the case with many dancers with the company in the early years, Miss McKinney Griffith's accomplishments faded over time, and her death on October 11th was not widely reported. She died of cancer at 74 at her home in Quaker Hill, Connecticut, her daughter, Khadija T. Griffith, said. Miss McKinney Griffith's stay at Juilliard turned out to be brief. She left the school in 1968 to join Arthur Mitchell, the first African-American principal dancer at New York City Ballet, and a global star, to join the daring new troupe he was starting with his former instructor, the ballet master Carol Shook. Miss McKinney Griffith served not only as the principal dancer at Dance Theater of Harlem, but also as the company's first ballet mistress. In that position, now known as rehearsal director, she was Mr. Mitchell's top lieutenant, responsible for running rehearsals, coaching dancers on choreography, helping with casting, and other tasks. Her Juilliard training proved invaluable. Quote, "In those early days, Arthur Mitchell needed really well-trained dancers," Virginia Johnson, a founding member of the company, said in an interview. She went on, "And she was that dancer. She had the technique and line to step into George Balanchine's Concerto Barocco with no question." Miss Johnson added, "Her dancing had a transcendent quality. She was musical and meticulous the way classical ballet requires." End quote. Miss McKinney Griffith toured the country and the world and performed for countless luminaries, including Stevie Wonder, Mick Jagger, and Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. But her legacy would not last. A point made clear in the book titled The Swans of Harlem, 5 Black Ballerinas, 50 Years of Sisterhood, and Their Reclamation of a Groundbreaking History, written by Karen Valby, which was published last month. The Swans of Harlem recounts the triumphs of Miss McKinney Griffith and her Dance Theater of Harlem colleagues Lydia Abarca Mitchell, Sheila Rowan, Carla Shelton Benjamin, and Marcia Sells. It also recounts their disappointments, including, quote, "being robbed of laurels upon which they might now be resting," end quote, as Daniel Smith wrote in a recent review in the New York Times, by being consigned to relative obscurity after their years on stage. As Miss Johnson put it, quote, "We were like celebrities, but when the company closed, it was as if Dance Theater of Harlem ceased to exist even in history," end quote. Parentheses, Dance Theater of Harlem went on hiatus in 2004 because of financial challenges and reopened in 2012. In 2015, when Misty Copeland became the first black principal dancer at American Ballet Theater, the news media often portrayed her as if she were the first star, black ballerina. Ms. Johnson said, quote, "People took that to heart as if there had been no Lydia Abarca, no Gail McKinney, as if all the people who danced with us and Mitchell for 20 or 30 years had not existed." Gail Duncan McKinney was born on August 26, 1949, in Harlem, the daughter of Harold McKinney, a draftsman, and Millicent Herndon McKinney, a supervisor of telephone operators. When Gail was 5, she and the family moved to a colonial house on several acres in Quaker Hill in eastern Connecticut when her father took a job at the submarine manufacturing company Electric Boat. She started taking ballet lessons at Carnegie Hall when she was 3, and when she was about 10, she was performing the Four Swans variation in Swan Lake. She furthered her training in the American Dance Festival at Connecticut College in New London and was accepted at Juilliard after graduating from a nearby Waterford High School in 1967. Despite the prestige of being admitted to the Manhattan School, all was not easy there. As Miss Valby wrote, Juilliard initially steered Miss McKinney Griffith toward the modern dance program, even though she had a lengthy ballet resume. School officials told her in private, she said, that they believed it was the best direction for her since she would never find a spot with a professional ballet company because of her race. Distraught, she began to wonder why she was even attending the school. Little wonder that when she heard that Mr. Mitchell was starting a company, she was thrilled to have a chance to join. Miss McKinney Griffith remained with Dance Theater of Harlem until 1977, when she was hired by the choreographer Louis Johnson to coach the dancers, including Diana Ross, Nipsey Russell, and Michael Jackson, for the elaborately choreographed numbers in Sidney LeMay's 1978 film version of the Broadway hit The Wiz, an exuberant black retelling of The Wizard of Oz. She was quoted as saying in Miss Valby's book, "Like you had to teach Michael anything. He knew those steps yesterday. I felt so stupid just doing these little ease on down moves. How embarrassing!" Exclamation. End quote. In 1979, she accepted an invitation to perform in a production of the musical Showboat in Berlin. She remained in Berlin for the bulk of the 3 decades, teaching dance in several German cities as well as Austria, Switzerland, and Italy. In the 1990s, she joined the faculty of Indiana University, South Bend. She taught there for 3 years and helped create a dance department. In addition to her daughter, Miss McKinney Griffith is survived by a son, Don Griffith II, and a grandson. She continued to choreograph and dance through the 90s, and she never lost the thrill of opening moments before an audience. As she recalled in an interview with Miss Valby, she would knock on the stage 3 times for luck before each performance. She said, quote, "It's like there's an energy curtain, and then you break through. It's so powerful because that's when you break from your stress. No more training, no more pressure. You show your gift." End quote. Next article comes from the Malvern Daily Record. Hot Spring County's only daily news source since 1916. Statue of Daisy Gatson Bates to be placed in United States Capitol. This was posted May 7th. I do not see an author's byline. Dateline Washington, D.C. Daisy Gatson Bates will become the 13th woman to be represented in the National Statuary Hall collection in the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C. on May 8, 2024. Bates, best known as the mentor to the Little Rock Nine, was also co-publisher of the Arkansas State Press, author of The Long Shadow of Little Rock, president of the Arkansas State Conference of the NAACP, and the only woman to formally address the 1963 March on Washington, where Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech. Arkansas Secretary of State John Thurston and Shane Broadway, chairman of the National Statuary Hall Steering Committee for Arkansas, made this announcement today following confirmation by U.S. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's office. Artist Benjamin Victor was commissioned to create the 7-foot-6-inch bronze sculpture, sponsored by Senator David Wallace and, pardon me, that's Dave Wallace and Representative Jeff Wardlaw of the Arkansas General Assembly. The statue and a statue of musician Johnny Cash replace Arkansas's two current statues that have been in the U.S. Capitol for over a century. Cash's unveiling by Arkansas artist Kevin Kress will take place at a later date. In 1964, Congress passed a law inviting each state to submit up to two bronze or marble statues to be placed in what is known as the National Statuary Hall. As the number of statues grew, the statues were housed in additional areas of the U.S. Capitol. In 1917, a marble statue of the late Uriah M. Rose, a founder of the Rose Law Firm and the American Bar Association. And in 1921, a marble statue of the late U.S. Senator and Governor James P. Clark was placed in National Statuary Hall, both approved by the Arkansas General Assembly. Secretary Thurston said, quote, "It is an honor to have a part in bringing the statue of Daisy Gatson Bates to the U.S. Capitol. Her life and legacy have shaped Arkansas's future, and we are proud to have her represent our great state in Statuary Hall. I am thankful for the diligent work of the Capitol Arts and Grounds Commission, Governor Asa Hutchinson for signing the legislation, and his work in fundraising." Daisy Gatson Bates biography. Daisy Gatson Bates was an activist and publisher. She is best known for her role as mentor and advisor to the group of nine students who integrated Little Rock Central High School in 1957. Bates dedicated her life to the struggle against injustice and was among the country's fiercest and most steadfast advocates for civil rights. Born Daisy Lee Gatson in Hutting, Arkansas, on November 11, 1914, Bates was raised by friends of her parents. When Bates was very young, her mother was raped and murdered by three white men in Hutting, pardon me, that's Huttig, who were never called to account for their crime. Devastated and facing intimidation from white residents of Huttig, that is spelled H-U-T-T-I-G, Bates's father fled, leaving his young daughter with Susie and Orlie Smith. The Smiths raised Bates as their own, and it was not until she was 8 years old that she learned that she was not their biological daughter. Bates also learned of the tragic circumstances of her mother's death. In 1929, at the age of 15, Bates met Lucius Christopher L.C. Bates, a traveling insurance salesman and a one-time journalist. Over the next decade, a romance developed between Bates and her older suitor. In 1941, the two moved to Little Rock, where Elsie's dreams of returning to journalism were realized when the couple started the Arkansas State Press. This small newspaper quickly earned a reputation for stories dealing with themes of injustice and violence against blacks in the South. The couple married in 1942 and soon became prominent members of the black community in Little Rock. The Arkansas State Press was the dominant civil rights voice of the region, and the Bateses became deeply involved with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. During this time, Bates also enrolled in classes at both Shorter College and Philander Smith College, She was elected president of the Arkansas State Conference of NAACP branches in 1952. This position set Bates up to be a central figure in what was becoming known as the civil rights movement. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, that segregated education was inherently unequal. In 1956, the Arkansas NAACP, and through it, Bates, became involved in a legal effort to enforce this ruling, which was being actively resisted by whites in the South. In its attempt to integrate Little Rock Central High School, the NAACP chose 9 black students who would come to be known as the Little Rock Nine to be the first to enroll in the fall of 1957. As the president of the State Conference of NAACP branches, Bates became one of the primary leaders in this effort. Her house was used both for strategy meetings and as a place for the students to gather. To the students, Bates became a mentor and advisor, helping them to understand both the specifics of what they were about to go through, as well as the larger implications of the events about to unfold. As the start of school approached in the fall of 1957, crowds of angry whites began to gather around Central High, protesting desegregation and attempting to block the 9 students from entering the building. The day before the school was to open, Orville Faubus, the governor of Arkansas, called in the National Guard, which surrounded Central High, and were ordered not to let the black students in. The Little Rock Nine, along with Bates, attempted to enter the school on September 3, 1957, but were turned away. Riots, protests, and a number of violent incidents followed. Bates and the Nine made several more attempts to gain access to the school, but it was not until Dwight Eisenhower federalized the Arkansas National Guard and sent in the 101st Airborne Division that the students were permanently able to attend Little Rock Central High School. As a result of the notoriety, that this episode brought, Bates became a target for harassment, both from anonymous disgruntled citizen and through the legal system. Nervous advertisers began to pull away from the Arkansas State Press, and in 1959, she and her husband were forced to shut the paper down. In 1960, Bates moved to New York, where she began work on her memoir, The Long Shadow of Little Rock, which would later become her first book, the first book, to win an American Book Award in reprint. Bates then moved to Washington, D.C., where she worked for the Democratic National Committee and the Johnson administration. She was forced to return to Little Rock, however, after suffering a stroke in 1965. Throughout the late 60s and 70s, Bates worked with impoverished African American communities to help them achieve economic self-sufficiency. She revived the Arkansas State Press in 1984 and that same year received an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from the University of Arkansas. In the late 1980s, an elementary school in Little Rock was named after Bates, and in 1996, at the age of 82, she had the honor of carrying the Olympic torch during the Summer Games in Atlanta. On November 4, 1999, Bates died in Little Rock, Arkansas. While Bates had no children of her own, she nurtured not only those 9 students who participated in the immense and courageous action in the fall of 57, but also countless others who were inspired by her exemplary life. Bates is also remembered, Bates is best remembered, for her role in the events surrounding the Little Rock Nine. She even received a posthumous Congressional Medal of Honor for her participation, but her true legacy is in the lifetime of tireless effort she invested in fighting against injustice, poverty, and discrimination. Next, some excerpts about this vet and his horse. First one is just one paragraph from the African American Veterinary History from Missouri.edu. Dr. William Key was an ex-slave, self-taught veterinarian, Civil War veteran, horse whisperer, and entrepreneur. trained his famous horse with only kindness and patience. His horse, Beautiful Jim Key, was an educated horse who could read, spell, do math, and more. Together, they energized the worldwide animal welfare movement, making the phrase, be kind to animals, a household phrase. And the next piece about both the horse and the man comes from the humananimalconnection.org, written by Jeannie Joseph. This was posted back in April of 2022. An educated horse, Beautiful Jim Key. The world's most educated horse was Jim Key, K-E-Y. Born in 1889, he could count to 30, could add and subtract, move the hands of a clock to tell the correct time, knew the alphabet, and would select letters from his special board to spell words and common names. He once beat sixth graders in a spelling contest as he was the only one who could correctly spell words like Constitution, Physics, and the name Isaac. He could answer yes or no to questions, would express political opinions, and insisted he was a Democrat, even when meeting Republican presidents. Jim could write his first name on a chalkboard, but didn't much like the taste of chalk, so preferred to place his letters on his special board. Jim Key was Mahogany Bay, a deep brown, with a black mane and a very long black tail, which reached almost to the ground. He was a large Arabian-Hambletonian mix at 16 hands. Jim Key loved to delight audiences and was an amazing comedic performer who demonstrated inexplicable, improvised feats. During one performance when President Roosevelt's daughter Alice was in the audience, he, quote, predicted her future fiancé by spelling out her entire married name, even though at the time Alice wasn't even engaged to the gentleman. Jim Key dazzled and amazed an estimated 10 million people who came to see him at the world's fairs and exhibitions, and just as impressive was his person, Doc Key, who taught him everything. Dr. William Key was born a slave in Shelbyville, Tennessee, most likely in 1833. The wife of his master taught him to read alongside her two children, even though it was against the law to teach slaves to read or write. Even as a child, William Key showed extraordinary abilities to heal and tame all animals and was often sent to neighboring plantations to doctor sick and injured animals. He was able to train horses, mules, ponies, dogs, roosters, goats, and other animals to perform amazing tricks. As a free man, he had a colorful life, escaping death at the hands of the Ku Klux Klan, captured during the Civil War, and accused of being a spy for the North, and many other brilliant life-saving strategies, including winning his freedom from captivity in a high-stakes poker game with white officers. As an adult, Doc Key rescued a former prized Arabian horse, Loretta, who had been badly abused by multiple circuses. Loretta's owners laughed at him when he offered to buy the, quote, broken-down horse, Loretta, for $40. But Doc Key nursed her back to health. Loretta, rumored to have been stolen from an Arabian prince, then sold to a B.T. Barnum circus for $50,000, was then passed down to lesser circuses where she was mistreated and abused. Doc Key nursed her back to health and thought she would give birth to a champion racehorse. But when she gave birth to Jim Key, he was a colt with crooked, spindly legs who could barely walk. Everyone told the doctor he should put the young horse out of his misery. But as a self-trained veterinarian, Doc Key used Keystone, a liniment he had created, and other healing methods, including letting the crippled horse sleep next to him in his house. Jim Key healed into a very strong and elegant horse, The bond and the love between them were very strong, and Jim Key followed the Doc around like a dog. Doc Key began to realize that Jim Key was beginning to outsmart him, finding apples hidden in a drawer and closing the door after he finished helping himself. He seemed to understand so much that Doc Key decided to train him. His wife had discovered that Jim Key would nod yes if asked if he wanted an apple, and that inspired Doc Key to begin patient and kind training with learning the alphabet, with letters laced in sugar at first. All through their lives together, Doc Key valued Jim Key's feelings and always asked his horse's opinions on a variety of subjects, including when he wanted a vacation, when he wanted to return to performing, and when it was time to retire. Jim Key's opinions often surprised him. Jim Key started learning through imitation. As a still crippled colt, he would watch Doc Key's dog and soon could do all the tricks the dog could do. This showed Doc he was no ordinary horse. Using teaching methods of kindness, patience, and persistence, Doc Key realized he had a star on his hands. For the first few years, the Doc had a medicine show where he would present Jim Key as he sold his miracle cure liniment, which worked on people as well as animals. When people saw the horse perform, they would try to bid hundreds of dollars to buy him. As soon as the Doc pronounced sold, Jim would put on a display of illness and lameness and appeared to be at death's door. The sale was immediately canceled. Then Doc would treat him with Keystone liniment, and the horse would immediately spring back to life. Doc Key and Jim had their own customized railroad car for traveling, and a Broadway show in New York City called The Scholar and the Model Office Boy, and regularly received standing ovations. The consummate performer, Jim Key, would ham it up even for more appreciative audiences and would often pick one woman in the audience with whom to flirt, smiling, swishing his tail, and prancing for just her. Many famous guests came to see him, including Booker T. Washington, composer John Philip Sousa, William Taft, and President McKinley. Jim Key would correctly answer questions from the audience and perform amazing feats of intelligence. There were many accusations of it all being a hoax, but no one was ever able to prove that. Doc Key invited a team of Harvard professors to test the horse. They tested him for hours without the Doc being present and couldn't find any evidence of the horse being cued, as a horse named Clever Hands had inadvertently been. They announced their conclusions that Jim Key was highly educated. To further prove Jim Key really thought out his own answers, Doc Key was happy to have reporters test Jim Key without him being present, but asked them to have an apple in their pocket. One reporter, who was at first convinced that the horse was hypnotized by the doctor, came and interviewed Jim Key. The horse spelled out all the correct answers with his letter board, and the reporter exited without giving Jim Key the apple he was expecting. The reporter left a believer, but when Doc Key asked his horse how it went, Jim Key spelled out the word fruitless. At a time when it was believed that horses could not feel pain and were routinely whipped and mistreated, 25,000 horses died each year in the streets of New York City from abuse and overwork. It was time to change the minds of men! Jim Key did more to educate the public than any human could do. It was just the beginning of the humane movement and educating the public that animals needed to be better cared for. In a newspaper article in the Atlanta Constitution on December 23, 1898, in a story called A Tribute to Jim Key, the author wrote, quote, "It is hoped that those who have met Jim Key will have carried away with them a kinder regard toward animals and will go forth resolved to whatever may be in their power for the care of our friends." End quote. A portion of the proceeds of Jim Key's shows went to the nascent humane societies. Jim Key was changing the current perception about animals, It was undeniable that Jim Key was a sentient being. He was an ambassador for not only horse intelligence, but provided living proof of an animal's potential inner life and the need to treat animals humanely. As a result of seeing a horse trained by kindness, over 2 million children signed the pledge to be kind to animals. Jim Key opened the eyes of the world. He had emotions, thoughts, and opinions. His relationship with Doc Key was the stuff that dreams are made of. Please spread this story to anyone you think might enjoy it. His memory lives on. Thank you, Doc Key, and sweet Jim Key. You are masters in the art of human-animal communication. You inspire me every day. Signed by Jeannie Joseph, PhD, Executive Director, the Human-Animal Connection. And she references at the bottom, here is a promotional booklet, The Story of Beautiful Jim Key, written at the time by Albert Rogers. If you would like to learn more, and it's titled, How He Was Taught, The Story of Beautiful Jim Key, the most wonderful horse in all the world. He was taught by kindness. That's all on the title page, or the front cover of the book. Other publications follow. One is an announcement of a performance. It says, in some locations, schools were closed to allow children to see performances of Jim Key. Doc Key insisted that audiences could not be whites only. Another book. This book, Beautiful Jim Key, The Lost History of the World's Smartest Horse, by Mim Eichler Rivas, tells the story of Doc and his horse in the historical context of the end of slavery, the Civil War, and other significant events of the times. It documents his performing career and has many interesting facts. There are at least 3 children's books written about Beautiful Jim Key. 1, Step Right Up, How Doc and Jim Key Taught the World About Kindness, is beautifully illustrated, and one I read to students in our HAC classes, as his history lives on, continuing to inspire a new generation about kindness to animals. Next article will be heavily edited for length. I will just read excerpts. It comes from the New York Times. First patient begins newly approved sickle cell gene therapy. A 12-year-old boy in the Washington, D.C. area faces months of procedures to remedy his disease. He said, I want to be cured. And this was published May 6th, written by Gina Colata, and photographs by Kenny Holston, it says. On Wednesday, Kendrick Cromer, a 12-year-old boy from a suburb of Washington, became the first person in the world with sickle cell disease to begin a commercially approved gene therapy that may cure the condition. For the estimated 20,000 people with sickle cell in the United States who qualify for the treatment, the start of Kendrick's months-long medical journey may offer hope, but it also signals the difficulties patients face as they seek a pair of new sickle cell treatments. Near the end of last year, the Food and Drug Administration gave 2 companies authorization to sell gene therapy to people with sickle cell disease, a genetic disorder of red blood cells that causes debilitating pain and other medical problems. An estimated 100,000 people in the United States have sickle cell, most of them black. People are born with the disease when they inherit the mutated gene for the condition from each parent. The treatment helped patients in clinical trials, but Kendrick is the first commercial patient for Bluebird Bio, a Somerville, Massachusetts company. Another company, Vertex Pharmaceuticals of Boston, declined to say if it had started treatment for any patients with its approved CRISPR gene editing-based remedy. Kendrick, whose family's health insurance agreed to cover the procedure, began his treatment at Children's National Hospital in Washington. Wednesday's treatment was only the first step Doctors removed his bone marrow stem cells, which Bluebird will then genetically modify in a specialized lab for his treatment. That will take months. The whole process is so involved and time-consuming that Bluebird estimates it can treat the cells of only 85 to 105 patients each year. And that includes not only just sickle cell patients, but also patients with a much rarer disease, beta thalassemia, who can receive a similar gene therapy. Medical centers also have the capacity to handle only a limited number of gene therapy patients. Each person needs expert and intensive care. Children's National can accept only about 10 gene therapy patients a year. Last week, Kendrick came prepared for the stem cell collection. He has spent many weeks in this hospital being treated for pain so severe that on his last visit, even morphine and oxycodone could not control it. He brought his special pillow with a Snoopy pillowcase that his grandmother gave him and his special Spider-Man blanket. And he had a goal. He said, quote, "I want to be cured." His parents, Deborah and Keith, had no idea they might have a child with sickle cell. They found out only when Deborah was pregnant with Kendrick. Tests showed that her baby would have a 1 in 4 chance of inheriting the mutated gene from each parent and have sickle cell disease. They could terminate the pregnancy or take a chance. They decided to take a chance. The news that Kendrick had sickle cell was devastating. He had his first crisis when he was 3. Sickled blood cells had become trapped in his legs and feet. Their baby was inconsolable, in such pain that Deborah couldn't even touch him. She and Keith took him to Children's National. Deborah said, "Little did we know that that was our introduction to many, many ER visits." The pain crisis became more and more severe. It seemed as though anything could set them off. 10 minutes of playing volleyball, a dip in a swimming pool. And when they occurred, Kendrick sometimes needed 5 days to a week of treatment in the hospital to control his pain. His parents always stayed with him. Deborah slept on a narrow bench in the hospital room. Keith slept in a chair. Deborah said, "We'd never dream of leaving him." Kendrick wants to be like other kids, but fear of pain crisis has held him back. He became increasingly sedentary, spending his days on his iPad, watching anime, or building elaborate Lego structures. Despite his many absences, Kendrick kept up in school, maintaining an A average. Deborah and Keith began to hope for gene therapy, but when they found out what it would cost, they lost some of their hope. But their insurer approved the treatment in a few weeks, they said, and now it has begun. Next, I'll pull from several articles, excerpts for the next topic. First from the New York Times. It's a review. Black Twitter looks at who gave the platform its voice. Hulu's docuseries on a social media subculture doubles as a serious snapshot of recent history. This is written by James Poniewozik, posted on May 9th. Who created Twitter? On one level, the business level, the answer is simple. Twitter, a social media service allowing users to post brief messages, was founded in 2006 by Jack Dorsey, Noah Glass, Biz Stone, and Evan Williams. But on the level of culture, the people who, quote, create a social platform, that is, who decide what it's for and what it can do, how it feels, are the people who use it. Titled Black Twitter, A People's History, which arrives on Hulu on Thursday, argues that it was black users who, as much or more than anyone, gave Twitter its voice. A couple of caveats are useful here. Though Twitter, now called X, is a global info system with worldwide effects, the three-part documentary, based on a Wired oral history by Jason Parham, focuses mainly on Twitter as an American phenomenon. And Black Twitter, the series, is careful to point out, isn't a monolith or a formal group, but the more general phenomenon of blackness and black culture manifesting online. The docuseries Black Twitter treats the network not mainly as technology or business, but as a cultural artifact. Oh, pardon me. I'm going to start that over. It's in quotes, but they don't mean the docuseries. Black Twitter treats the network not mainly as technology or business, but as a cultural artifact, a platform, even an art form, for commentary, community, and comedy. Twitter, it argues, is another part of American culture, like music and food, that Black Americans defined by coming to it from the margins. Quote, in the same way that we took our lamentations and made gospel music, we took a site like Twitter and we made it into a storytelling forum, end quote. Meredith Clark, a journalism professor undertaking an archive of Black Twitter, says in the documentary, or as the comedian Brontunde Thurston pithily puts it, quote, we repurpose Twitter the way we repurpose chitlins, end quote. This scaffolding of ideas elevates Black Twitter above the kind of remember this, remember that pop history documentary that it can resemble on the surface. Appropriate to its subject, it tells its story in a series of small bites. It stitches together interviews with academics, journalists, entertainers, viral stars, and figures from business and politics with a nimble narration by the director, Prentice Penny. In the early, janky, manual retweet days of Twitter, it wasn't clear what the medium was going to be for, but it was fast, conversational, and accessible, an open space to create community. The development of hashtags, a workaround for Twitter's search function, allowed users to plant signposts for instant conversations. One of them, hashtag you know you're black when, coined by the Twitter user Ashley Weatherspoon in 2009, became a sort of origin story for Black Twitter. Wildly viral. Parentheses. According to Parham's original story, it at one point accounted for 1.2% of all Twitter traffic. It became a magnet for riffs, family stories, self-deprecating exaggerations. Far-flung users improvised in the moment a collective definition of a culture. This is how social media comedy often functions. Making a joke produces a laugh, but getting a joke produces a connection. Twitter had jokes, but the jokes could also have a purpose, as when the tag hashtag Oscars so white crystallized a protest against the lack of diversity in Hollywood's award and reward systems. Hashtagging was one way, Black Twitter argues, that Black users shaped Twitter's vernacular. Another was through memes, which allowed a layered visual vocabulary for mood, irony, emotion, and attitude. Black people, the documentary argues, were pioneers of memes as language, and often the faces of it, colon, Michael Jackson munching popcorn to convey excited spectatorship, James Harden eye-rolling away from an interviewer for wry dismissal, Donald Glover walking into a burning room for surprised horror, and of course, the pietà of memes, crying Jordan. Like any social platform, Twitter is people. Its history is human history. So Black Twitter doubles as a social history of America from the beginning of the Obama era to the aftermath of the Trump era. An arc of hope to disillusionment to acrimony. It begins nostalgically with the election of the first Black president, who was also an early Twitter adopter, and memories of over-the-top online beefs and scandal watch parties. With the killings of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, Black Twitter served as a crowdsourced information network and protest forum. The hashtag #IfTheyGunMeDown invited Black users to post pairs of photos of themselves, grimly satirizing the tendency of media outlets to choose the most menacing images of Black people shot by the police. If there's an optimistic takeaway from this fast impressionistic history, it's that Black Twitter is really a phenomenon that preceded Twitter, as seen in Black users' early embrace of outlets like MySpace, and that it will persist elsewhere if it comes to that. Parentheses, already, the documentary says, its energy is in some ways shifting to video platforms like TikTok. Black Twitter, a people's history, doesn't have grand predictions about what comes next, but it's an engagingly specific snapshot of the Twitter era and the social period it overlapped with, a time that was serious even when it was silly, that was fun until it wasn't. Next, turning to the article that originally inspired the docuseries, which was from 2021, by Jason Parham from Back Channel, Wired magazine. A People's History of Black Twitter. This is from part one. From #YouKnowYou'reBlackWhen to #BlackLivesMatter. How a loose online network became a pop culture juggernaut, an engine of social justice, and a lens into the future. Near the end of 2009, during the twilight months of a decade that saw the first Black man elected to the U.S. presidency, Ashley Weatherspoon was chasing virality on a young app called Twitter. As the personal assistant for the singer Adrian Bailon, a former member of the pop group Cheetah Girls, Weatherspoon often worked on social media strategy. For weeks, she and Bailon had been testing out hashtags on both their feeds to see what would connect with fans. A mild success came with variations on #YouKnowYourBoyfriend'sCheatingWhen. Later, on a car ride around Manhattan, they began playing with #YouKnowYou'reFromNewYorkWhen. Quote, "We started going ham on it," Weatherspoon told me when we spoke over the phone in June, as the two women were laughing and joking, an even better idea popped into Weatherspoon's head. She says, "Then I said, oh, you know you're Black when." It was the first Sunday in September at exactly 4:25 p.m. when Weatherspoon logged onto Twitter and wrote, #YouKnowYou'reBlackWhen, you cancel plans when it's raining. The hashtag spread like wildfire. Within 2 hours, 1.2% of all Twitter correspondents revolved around Weatherspoon's hashtag. As Black users riffed on everything from car rims to tall trees, it was the viral hit she was after, and confirmation of a rich fabric being threaded together across the platform. Here in all its melanated glory was Black Twitter. More than a decade later, Black Twitter has become the most dynamic subset not only of Twitter, but of the wider social internet, capable of creating, shaping, and remixing popular culture at light speed. It remains the incubator of nearly every meme, parentheses, crying Jordan, this you, #IfTheyGunMeDown, #OscarSoWhite, #YouOKSis, and social justice cause, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, worth knowing about. It is both news and analysis, call and response, judge and jury, a comedy showcase, therapy session, and family cookout all in one. Black Twitter is a multiverse, simultaneously an archive and an all-seeing lens into the future. As Weatherspoon puts it, quote, "Our experience is universal, our experience is big, our experience is relevant," end quote. Though Twitter launched exactly 15 years ago today, With the goal of changing how and how quickly people communicate online, the ingenious use of the platform by Black users can be traced in a way much further back in time. In 1970, when the computer revolution was in its infancy, Amiri Baraka, the founder of the Black Arts Movement, published an essay called Technology and Ethos. How do you communicate with the great masses of Black people? He asked. What is our spirit? What will it project? What machines will it produce? What will they achieve? End quote. For Black users today, Twitter is Baraka's prophetic machine. Voice and community, power and empowerment. To use his words, it has become a space to, quote, imagine, to think, to construct, to energize, 3 exclamation points, end quote. What follows is the first official chronicling of how it all came fantastically together. Like all histories, it is incomplete, but it is a beginning, an outline. Think of it as a kind of record of Blackness, how it moves and thrives online, how it creates, how it communes, told through the eyes of those who lived it. The following I will read, just one or two comments from each section for time. Coming together from 2008 to 2012, as early web forums like Black Voices, Melanet, and Net Noir fizzled out in the mid-2000s, online spaces that catered to Black interests were scarce. Black Planet and MySpace failed to fill the void. And Facebook didn't quite capture the essence of real-time communication. Users were looking for the next thing. Each quote from a different person here. Pre-2007, we never had a conversation about almost anything. As a community, we didn't talk all, pardon me, we didn't all talk about what it was like when we sang the national anthem or what it was like when OJ was driving in that white Bronco. We just watched it on TV. Another says, I had all those things, Black Planet, MySpace, LiveJournal. I was on Facebook when you needed an invite to get on. I was kind of just bored. So I was like, okay, what's a tweet? What y'all talking about over there? Another, Facebook was just slow. Twitter was new and fun. Another, almost immediately I realized this was a subsection of Twitter, and yet it was very clear that we were running the whole thing. Another, it was so quintessentially Black, it was like, who's the funniest? Another one, I was like, okay, there's some funny people on here, and most of those people are Black, and also in college. It felt like being on the quad. Another, we didn't know what other people were thinking before Twitter. It was groundbreaking. I realize now I'm going to run out of time, so I'll cut the comments sections and go just for the encapsulations. It was a sense of community that crystallized on June 25th, 2009, when Michael Jackson, never on Twitter himself, but a reliable source of joy, inspiration, and reaction gifts, was checked into a hospital in Los Angeles. Days later, the BET Awards were held at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, not far from the hospital where Jackson died. By the end of 2009, the Black presence on Twitter was undeniable, and the media began referring to it as the Black Twitter, pardon me, simply as Black Twitter, a term not everyone embraced at first. As the notion of Black Twitter took off, celebrities, musicians, and other artists joined in, attracting more media attention and more users. Entertainment continued to fuel the early days, pardon me, the early years of Black Twitter, culminating in one of the most unlikely events yet, the 2012 premiere of Scandal on ABC. Of course, it wasn't all champagne and good times. The burgeoning cultural force that was Black Twitter came with its share of problems, some downright nasty. Then, on February 26, 2012, a young boy in Sanford, Florida, was fatally shot on his way back from the local 7-Eleven. What users couldn't foresee, even as they continued to speak up, was that an even bigger storm was on the horizon. The fight for Black lives would become the most transformational movement, not simply for Twitter, but for the entire country. Nothing would be the same ever again. And that's the end of the part one of this 2021 article. And once again, that docuseries is Black Twitter, A People's History, and is currently available streaming on Netflix. That brings us to the end of our hour for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. This was the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.